special edition of Voices, in which we get to hear programs drawn from the WERU archives in this WERU's 20th anniversary year. I'm Jim Campbell. Over its 20-year history, WERU has served and continues to serve as a voice of many voices. The voices we'll hear today will be familiar to longtime WERU listeners, although one of them can sadly only be heard in rebroadcasts like this one. In today's program, we'll hear again an edition of Art Matters. This edition was recorded and first broadcast back in the mid-90s in WERU's first home, the Hen House in South Blue Hill. The topic today is music. Kathy Melio, longtime WERU volunteer, staff member, and then volunteer again, is the host, and musicians and composers Mary Cheney Gould, Paul Sullivan, and Kay Gardner are the guests. Kay, who is one of the originators of Women's Windows, a program that's still running on WERU on Sunday evenings, passed away in 2002, but this is an opportunity to hear her voice again, as well as the voices and insights and experience of these other fine locally based musicians.
Good morning. It's time for Art Matters in Maine. I'm Kathy Melio, your host, and we're joined here today by Mary Cheney Gould, Paul Sullivan, and Kay Gardner. Art Matters is a program in which we take a look at a specific art form and discuss with people who work in that area its importance not only to their own lives, but to the life of the community and the world. Welcome, and thanks for coming over to the Hen House this morning.
Thank you, Kathy.
Now, I assume, of course, that everyone knows who all three of you are, but I will start by asking you to tell our listeners a little bit about who you are and your involvement in music. Kay Gardner and Paul Sullivan, of course, are very well-known musicians. We have a number of their recordings here at the station. Mary Cheney Gould is a musician, and also let's hear about your role at the Bagaduce Music Lending Library and a little about that organization.
Well, the Bagaduce Music Lending Library is an outgrowth of a need that we found when the Bagaduce Chorale had too much music and wanted to share it. That goes back some 20 years, a little more than that, and both of those organizations have been rolling along and keeping me and a lot of other people very busy. Great fun for a musician who thought she was retiring 25 years ago from all things musical, but having been into all kinds of keyboard music, organ, piano, harp, and choral music, and so on, in all its various forms, to have an opportunity to use all of those experiences and pull it together is sort of fun.
And you also are involved in a local steel drum band.
Well, that's the more recent thing. I was just thinking that music has wonderful aspects to it, and one of the greatest is that it leads you in directions you didn't expect to go. I never in this world thought I'd be there, but I'm having a great time with it.
Mary, was your love of music and connection with it, did it come at an early age?
Oh, yes, very early. My family were all musical, and I remember sitting on my mother's lap to reach the keys of the piano before. And most of us, I think, start that way.
Kay and Paul, did you both come to music at a very early age?
Well, I did. I guess I played piano as soon as I could reach the keyboard, my mother says. And when I was four, they started me on lessons. But it wasn't until I was eight that I really found my instrument, which was the flute. And I really feel that everybody has an instrument. And so I did come early to it, and it just seemed like breathing. It always has seemed like breathing to me.
How about you, Paul Sullivan?
Well, I would say, with the exception of switching to the flute, my musical biography is exactly the same as Kay's. Just the same naturalness. From my earliest earliest memories are of being the piano man. I remember, you know, I always had to play at kindergarten for when the kids marched in and out and all that stuff. So it's just always been my life. And I, as I say, the only difference is I think piano was my instrument right from the start.
And I mentioned in the promotional announcement for this program that music is the art form that everyone just, I mean, I think you can say everyone relates to, needs, is connected to. So I think you're all... in some way, I think you're all probably lucky among artists to be involved in an art form that has a wide appreciation. Kay, you've had so many experiences with music. I don't know where to begin, but I'd love to let our listeners understand a little of the breadth of your musical experience. So can we talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Where do you want me to start?
Well, you have you're one of the founders, in a way, of the women's music, the movement of women's
industry.
Music. Mm-hmm. Just tell us a little about that as a starting point.
Well, I was a classical musician and have a master's in performance on flute, but I didn't really want to go that route. I didn't want to get dressed up in the gown and the high heels and be a recitalist. And I didn't want to play in orchestras anymore. I'd had for years, and they were kind of anonymous. And I loved chamber music, but there wasn't a whole lot that I hadn't played on the flute. And when the women's music, when the women's movement started getting strong, well, music came out of it. And mostly it was like girl with guitar, singing songs that reflected feminist lyrics. And I was an instrumentalist, and I couldn't figure out, well, where do I fit in here? So I started doing a lot of research on ancient women's music and what instruments they used and what modes they played in or different scales. And I started writing consciously in those scales and using that instrumentation. And with other women, founded record labels that did not insult women, that accepted our music as our gift and didn't put us on the album covers with low decolletage in order to sell, you know, an album. And we wanted to be accepted on who we were. So I was part of the group that started these record labels, alternative labels. We don't need them now. I mean, because now the mainstream is totally accepting of the work that we kind of pioneered all those years. But it was a challenge, but it also kind of defined my style and the kind of music that I continue to write.
And you have a number of recordings out there available to people. I won't ask you to list them, but it would be fun to just talk a little about some of them. You have recorded albums relating to music and healing.
Yes, that was a pretty much during the 1980s. I worked exclusively in what it was that made music healing, and then apply that to my own composition. Now, I'm still working with that. I've just signed a contract with a recording label that is outside the women's music industry, which is a first for me, to do an album on their healing music series. And it'll be basically some of the drone instruments from all around the world, and then on top of those, I'll do some flute improvisations on various global flutes. So I'm still in that music and healing, and it's very interesting to me, and I know that music is a healing force. I'm sure all of us can agree to that.
I think so. You all have involvement with music in your community. Paul, I know you go into a local nursing home once a month, and tell us a little about that.
I do. Well, that's my longest-running gig, I would say. I've been doing it for... probably 7 or 8 years or so, 6 or 7 anyway. The Penobscot Nursing Home once a month, and it's a tremendous thing. You know, at first it started off as a desire to do something good for people, but, you know, I didn't know anyone there. But then it gradually evolved, very quickly evolved into just something that I really like to do, and I really don't think of it now as... public service of any kind. I just once a month we make our date and we show up, and there's another woman in Brooksville who comes and joins me. She used to be on the staff of the nursing home, and I've had various people come along and sing, and anyone is welcome to join me. It's a very relaxed and very, I mean, the cliche, of course, is that the beauty of the contact, of the communication that the music makes, is the exact same beauty that is available in any musical communication, and it's as good as you can find anywhere. The music may not be. I have my good days and bad days, and as I say, you know, we have a kind of a open mic policy, so sometimes it's a little more polished than others, but the contact, you know, musical contact is musical contact, whether it's Carnegie Hall or Penobscot Nursing Home. It's touching people's hearts,
and
or everyone touching each other's heart. That's mm-hmm. different than saying touching people's hearts, because it's, you know, you all, everyone, we each throw our little stick into the campfire and enjoy the glow.
But when you do something like that, I mean, you are a world-class musician. You're going off to Croatia for an Earth Day concert with Paul Winter. You're writing musical scores for Palabolas and producing your own great albums, and yet you understand the importance of music in your own community, of going into schools and working with teenagers, of going into nursing homes and bringing that healing power and that wonderful energy of music into your community. And I know all three of you do that in a way, and we'll get into that a little bit more here.
Yeah, I'd like to just say that, you know, it may seem as though it's some noble enlightenment on my part to be, you know, able to do fancy things and yet go to the Penobscot Nursing Home. But one thing, I've always been proud of being a musician, proud of fellow musicians. And I feel the older I get and the more experience I have is that that concept of the universality of music, the absolute parody of a Penobscot Nursing Home with, you know, a huge... most musicians I know, especially as we ripen and mature, find that absolutely a matter of course. You know, I don't think I have any unique perspective on that. I think certainly the ladies here are with us, and, you know, I'm sure Isaac Stern would feel the same way. I'm sure he, you know, you get to a certain point where you realize it's got nothing to do with all the apparatus that so many people think it does have to do with. That, you know, the greatest musicians feel that just making contact with somebody, as a matter of fact, I vowed I wouldn't talk too long, but I have to tell this little story.
We'll let you. We have an hour here.
I remember here. a story I heard about Arthur Rubinstein, that he, when he'd be practicing in his apartment, he often would go out and ring the elevator and get the elevator man to come up to the floor and then ask him to come out so he could play to him, just so that there would be contact, you know? And that's all. He just needed to communicate with a fellow human being. And I think that's what we all want as musicians.
Gee, Paul, you do that with me every once in a while.
Yeah, but I have to walk down the stairs. It's too long.
Kathy, that's one of the things that we find with, and I've found over the years, say, with a choral group, that this is a group of local people, community people, who just love music. But the thing they tell me over and over again is that on Monday night, when it comes time to go to rehearsal, they can feel lower than a snake's belly and wish they didn't have to pull themselves together and drive 20 or 30 or, in some cases, 50 miles to go to a rehearsal for 2 hours. And yet, if they do make that effort, the mere communication of the music and the doing of the music together, even if you're woodshedding a piece that's tough and you go over and over and over to hear and get those rhythms, by the end of the evening, everybody is up and nobody goes to sleep before midnight.
And it happens. Well, that's the way it is.
I can agree, because with the women's choir, the Women with Wings that I lead in Bangor, I have seen music bring women out of their shells. I've seen women that maybe have mental disability or physical disability, just bring them to a place where that's totally forgotten with themselves and with others. They're totally part of a community. They're making music together, and it's such a joy. You can just see them radiating with joy. That is more satisfying than a stadium of people clapping for me. I mean, that's nothing. more satisfying is looking at the radiance in the faces of people who love to make music together.
And that's why this steel band thing is caught on, because it's such fun. People have just great joy in making music that they never thought they'd be able to do. And there they are, just a part of it. And it's joyous music, and they can do it.
Well, Mary, you conduct the Christmas chorale, the Bagadoos music?
The Bagadoos Chorale does three programs a year, a fall program, seasonal, and a spring concert. And then we participate in Blue Hill Pops, which happens on the night before 4th of July. And this year, Paul's going to be a big part of that one. But the chorale, a small group of chorale, is always in that program. So it gives us an ongoing schedule for the year with a little bit of time in between to catch our breaths and then to go for it again.
Well, I'd like to get Mary and Kay talking a little bit more about singing, a little bit more about, I mean, most people sing somewhere, whether it's in the car or the shower or with a group of other people, but you are both involved in seeing people blossom in that way. Why do you make time for that? Why does it matter to you to help people sing and find their voice?
Oh, because they love it so. And everybody can sing. There are very few people, in my experience, who really can't. Oh, Paul, of course you can. Of course you can. No, it really is true. There are, I can count fingers of one hand, the people I've known in my more than 70 years that really can't sing. Everybody can't. That's right. And honestly, and if they have, then they love to sing, whether it's, as you say, in the shower or whatever. But if they get some guidance, some direction, and it's empathy more than anything else is the thing that makes it happen with choral singing. You can just breathe and get them to breathe together, and they come in together. That's all it is.
Yeah, and when they're creating something together, that's another thing. It's not just their own vibes or, you know, the own vibrations coming through, which I think is a big part of the healing, because I think making sound is touching us in all parts of our bodies and healing us and kind of reorganizing our molecules and bringing healing. But doing it together, that is just a real joy. It's scary for them at first, those who've never done a concert. I remember when Women with Wings, when I said, well, we're going to do a concert, because usually we just sing in circle and we kind of bring up songs spontaneously. We don't learn a whole lot of songs with parts. But when we decided we would do it in concert, they were freaking out. But when they did it, they were so proud of themselves, and everyone could see the joy. I said, look, you want to sing the joy to the people who are listening. You want to show how much you enjoy this. And they did, and everyone felt that too. And so it's healing. It's a big circular thing.
That's right.
It's synergy too. The whole being more than
absolutely
each part.
Say it all the time to them.
And it's
one of the wonderful things about choral music is that the parts are really greater than comes together.
Yeah.
And when it comes down to a concert, say with the chorale, and everybody is standing all lined up and ready to go up, and think, oh, there's a whole church full of people, and I say to them, those people up there could sit at home on this lovely day, or perhaps a terrible day, and listen to the very best of music on their CDs or whatever. They could do that but they chose to come here because there is something that you give them in that immediate communication of being in the same room with this creative thing that's going on, of pulling it together, that they can't get anyplace else. So they come. Mm-hmm. So know that and turn on to that and play to it, you know. Address it.
That's what and as Mary said earlier, it's free. Everyone has a voice. You don't have to go out and invest an instrument. You have it. You're carrying it around with you.
And I notice with my little 2-year-old boy, a lot of times as he's falling asleep, I love just standing there and hearing him singing in his crib, finding his voice and realizing that this is innate. I mean, we need to sing. We need music. And if it's not there for us, we make it.
I trust you sing to him.
Oh, certainly. Well, Paul, I think, speaking of people working together and how all that happens musically, I think we'd all be interested in hearing a little bit about what it's like to play with the Paul Winter Consort, because there's a unique conglomeration of musicians.
I've played with Paul for about 10 or 12 years now on a catch-as-catch-can basis. Paul Halley is the co-founder and really the musical bedrock of the organization, and he is, you know, is the regular piano and keyboard player. But he's a busy man and has been over the years, and whenever he can't be there, I get a call, or usually. And so it's worked out to a wonderful balance, as far as I'm concerned, in that it never becomes a job. It never becomes, you know, I haven't played one concert with Paul that I didn't wish I was there for. And I know that if I had to play all of them, I'd feel that way, because everyone does. So every time I go out with him, it's like a combination of a fun adventure coupled with a class reunion. And Paul is a very, very family-oriented man, and up until now, he and his wife are expecting a child in August, but up until now, or up until a couple of years ago when he was married, he really was on his own, and so his musicians were his family. And he has the sense of community in playing with him is a tremendous thing, and I can illustrate with one example. One of the first concerts I ever played with him was down in Atlanta, and it was a regular full-length concert, and I think it was the first time I had ever played with the whole group. I had played a concert with Glenn and one with Eugene and various combinations, but this was the first time with the whole group, and it was really just soaring, and by the time intermission came, my head was about to pop off. It just was so exciting, and I went backstage with everybody, and there were lots of nice congratulations and hugs, and we were all just, high musicians, high for music, and, you know, all musicians know what I'm talking about. And we were just back there and still had another half to go, and I couldn't be more excited. And at one point, Eugene, after all kinds of nice words and compliments about this little solo and that sort of thing, he said, "Oh, and just remember to take that repeat on the first section of the such and such a piece." And I said, "Well, you mean I didn't do that?" And he said, "No, not this time." And I said, "But it felt completely right. I mean, there was no problem." He said, "No, there was no problem, because we heard what you did, and we just went there. But," he said, "you know, next time do the repeat." And I thought, boy, that is a combination of great musicianship, because there was, you know, it was absolutely seamless. And Eugene was the only one who even mentioned it, he being my closest friend. They probably wouldn't have even thought to do it, but they all had just completely covered for me and gently reminded me to do it right the next time. I just thought, boy, this
That's
is a group you can really be.
Is, isn't yeah. It, Paul?
Yeah, it really is.
Real
it,
ensemble.
Yeah.
And Paul, you're going to Croatia with the Paul Winter Consort for an Earth Day concert. Can you tell us a little about that?
I can't tell you much about it. I don't know that much myself, but we're going to Zagreb for Earth Day. I know Paul was there either last year or the year before, and we were going to go fly into Zagreb Monday, play the concert on Tuesday, and then fly home Wednesday morning, but they relented a bit, and now we're going to spend one extra day there. So we'll have
one day. And where will it be? What will be the setting?
I don't even... Paul told me who the sponsor was, but I think it's a kind of a consortium of music presenters there. And one thing I think will be great to see is... I'm assuming it will be a fascinating experience, and I'm sure we'll have meet some tremendous people. And in fact, I'm hoping that Vedran Smilovic, the cellist of Sarajevo, whom I wrote about, whom I met in England a couple of years ago, I suggested that we try to find him and get him to play with us. So and that's being worked on now. So that would be tremendous to meet him. But I also think it'll be interesting to remember that people are just still living their lives, and that even in such an upside-down place as Croatia, now, obviously, I don't know much about it. I'll see. I'll report back when I've been there. But obviously, if they're bringing in a music group from the United States to play a concert, there has to be some sense of normalcy and continuing human life. And I think it'll be great to see that in the midst of a place that is suffering so terribly.
It's important to know that music endures, and that in a time and place of strife, it's probably even more necessary. Kay, you have played in so many great combinations, but let's just hear a little bit about the Sun Woman Ensemble.
Well, this is a group of musicians that whenever I'm doing a recording, I'll call upon. And we play at the women's music festivals. It's really not a group that is ongoing. I mean, and it's of many different combinations. It's just that I call it that when I put them on a recording.
How did this all come together, this group?
Well, probably with Rainbow Path, which had 20 different musicians on different instruments, that I recorded that in 1984. And various women, like there's the violist I use is the first violist with the Royal Ballet in Canada, and she would come to all the festivals. Well, I found out she came to all the festivals, and I said, bring your viola next time, and we started to play together, and she was, like, super good. So I would find musicians from all over the country, wherever I went. Like, when I put this oratorio together for the National Women's Music Festival, I traveled all over the country. I was touring at the time, and I found my concert maestra in Santa Fe, and she plays with the New Mexico Symphony. So these are just women who are professional musicians in their own community who come to the festivals. We pull it together and play music together at the festivals. And then if I'm doing a recording of the same music, I pull them into the project.
And we're hearing them in the background. You're not. You folks don't have headphones on. But this is from the CD Garden of Ecstasy, Kay Gardner and Sun Woman Ensemble. You're listening to Art Matters. This morning we're talking about music, why it matters, with Mary Cheney Gould, Paul Sullivan, and Kay Gardner, and we'll be right back. We're here at the Hen House this morning talking about why music matters with Mary Cheney Gould, Paul Sullivan, and Kay Gardner. Mary, I think it would be interesting to talk about a little about the Bagadoos Music Lending Library and why it's important, why it matters that organization exists.
Well, we think it's important because its mission is to collect, preserve, and lend printed music. Not recorded music, but printed music. We found some years ago that more and more publishers were able to continue to publish only those works that sold very well, and that there, because absolute necessity for them to stay in business, and in that process, much music was being lost because it was no longer available, not published, not in print, and not available through the music stores. At the same time, there were fewer and fewer music stores that actually sold printed music. The music stores in our area, for instance, do a wonderful job with instruments, and they have a few how-to books on the back shelves often, and many times anthologies of popular songs that have really made it and become very popular. But for the hardcore business of real printed music, an inventory of music that would cover the whole history of music, it just didn't exist in our area. And people not only in our down east boonies, as we call it, but there are other boonies all over the country, all over the world for that matter, where music, printed music, is unavailable. So we started with some small collections, and my first concern was we didn't have enough music to say we were really a music library. But now we've come up to nearly 1,200 different donors of music. Sometimes it's been a whole truckload of choral music that's come up to us from Boston, or a single item that a borrower in Idaho thinks we ought to have. And our problem has been to find space for it and to organize it so that we could find it when somebody wants it, and then make a system so where those people could use it and get it back to us, and somebody else could use it. We now have most of the collection on the computer, so we can search things pretty well. A couple of years ago, there was a short article in Family Circle magazine that said that the Baggage Music Lending Library would be equal, would find any song that your grandmother loved or you said was your favorite song 20 years ago, just call them up and hum it, and they'll find it for you. Well, we were deluged, but we did learn to do a lot of searching that we might not have done otherwise. However, the library now consists of five major sections. We have a large choral collection of multiple copies as well as singles for research. We have keyboard music, which includes not only the piano solo, but organ and two piano and piano four hands, all of that kind of thing. We have an instrumental section, which has a chamber ensemble of all kinds, plus instruments, solos, flutes, the cello, all of the repertoire that belongs to those individual instruments, as well as two or more cellos or flutes or whatever. And then a vocal section, which is everything sung that isn't choral. That could be opera or music theater or those old songs of 20th century American popular music. It goes way back, or even pre-20th century. So the whole thing is to keep it organized and make it available. What has happened over the 12 years that we've been doing it is that we have borrowing members in all 50 states, and I believe it's presently at 6 foreign countries. That's quite wonderful, and the word is there. Our problem then is to just keep up with it and keep it ongoing.
But are there many such? Excuse me. Are there many such music lending libraries in our country?
Not to my knowledge. We have not been able to find any other that does it quite the way we do. There are, of course, music libraries in every college and university, which serve their own constituency, their own faculty and students. And there are music libraries in metropolitan areas for their own immediate area. But to actually lend the original music to somebody who is someplace else in the world, we haven't found that kind of orientation. No.
And you also sponsor a great speaker series.
Yes. Part of our mission is to have educational programs at the library. Paul was part of that. And Kay, yes, for the past several years, and Paul's on that education committee that pulls together. This last year we had the Best of Beethoven, and it was quite a best kind of thing. He turned out to have lots of facets that we weren't aware of before that.
Any that you care to share with us?
Well, you want to share the basic tenet of your talk, Paul,
about
Beethoven?
Well, I'll tell you the subtitle. It was Ludwig von Beethoven, Immortal Genius or No Good Bum.
Take it from there.
I thought we had so many weeks of adulation that I thought someone needed to
bring him down a notch.
A little debunking.
That's great.
But that shows the kind of irresponsible scholarship which we love to foster over there at the Baggy News Library. No, it's and it's sheer coincidence that I'm on the education committee and have given so many of the lectures too. No connection there whatsoever.
No connection at all, of course.
Kay, you're involved in a statewide organization called the Maine Composers Forum. Tell us a little about that.
Actually, we're all members.
Oh,
think about
yes.
it. Yes, but I'm on the board. I'm soon to retire from the board, but I am on the board, and we are looking forward to our New Sounds Blue Hill, which we started a couple years ago, which was a showcase for our composers. So we have all kinds of composers, those who write instrumental music, songwriters, singer-songwriters, jazz performers and composers. And we wanted to show the variety that we had within our membership, because we're everywhere from Kittery to Presque Isle, our membership goes. So we bring them all together in Blue Hill every 2 years, as it's turning out, and the next one will be the third weekend in October. And we'll have a kids' concert. It may not be free this year. we may charge a dollar at the door this time, where we have children who compose, performing their own works, as well as performers from our membership who specifically play to children. And we'll have a... Last time we did a concert with the Bagadoos Chorale and Mary Janey Gould on organ. This year we're going to do winds and strings. So each time we do it, we'll focus on different instruments from the classical composers. Then we'll have a rousing jazz concert, and we'll have a singer-songwriter marathon, which will be on its own and not conflicting with any other concerts as it did last time. So we've already organized it. Some of it will be held at the Left Bank Cafe and some at the Town Hall. And it should be a wonderful event. I'll still be in the organization, even though I'm not on the board.
And go ahead.
I was going to say that the music library has a collection called the Maine Collection, which is music written by Maine composers and about Maine. And it grew enormously as a result of the Composers Forum festival that took place in Blue Hill just a year and a half ago. And we look forward to that. With that collection can help people who are looking for music from a specific area of Maine or doing research into it and so on. We hope people will use it.
Maine does have quite a bit of musical activity, doesn't it?
Really? That's unbelievable. And not just the things that we get, the extra things that we get in the summertime when we get musicians from away coming up and doing their things, but it's just ongoing activities all over the state, and it's a real exciting environment.
Kay, I was wondering if any musicians out there were interested in learning more about the Maine Composers Forum. How would they find out?
Well, actually, you could drop me a card, and I'll forward it to the folks down in Portland who are kind of running it. And I'm at Post Office Box 33 in Stonington, if you remember that your old recordings went 33 and a third. It's a good way to remember my post office box. So just drop me a postcard, and I'll forward it down, and we'll get some information to you. Everyone who writes music is welcome to be a member.
Great. You're listening to Art Matters today. We're talking today about why music matters. I'm Kathy Melio, joined in the studio by Kay Gardner, Paul Sullivan, and Mary Cheney Gould. Well, Paul, those of us who have been your neighbor here in the hen house have been able to come upstairs and see your great setup and have seen you go from the you still obviously love the acoustic piano, but you have this whole new setup, which I have learned recently that Kay has also obtained the computerized keyboard, synthesizer, this whole magical thing that I'd like to get you both to talk about a little bit. Paul, you've obviously done a lot with it. You've created scores for Palobolus, and you're up there doing some new secret great projects. Just tell us a little about. Well, I guess what I'd like to hear about a little is making that transition. There are some musicians who maybe resist technology. Why was it important for you to get into this whole new area?
Well, kind of like why we all loved music from our earliest age. Excuse me. It's a little hard for me to figure out exactly why I'm so fascinated with synthesizers, because to me, the harder question to answer would be, why wouldn't someone who loves sound and music want to know more about this? And I know that people sometimes resist the technology of it and all, but I am really an absolute lover of the possibilities of electronic music, while certainly acknowledging the problems and the shortcomings and the disappointments and the frustrations of it. But none of them seem to discourage me in the slightest bit. I feel, you know, I've got a not a very fancy studio relative to many, many studios. It's this. Yeah, I have it in an office, basically, and it basically fits on two or three desktops, and it looks like an electric piano with a lot of VCR kind of black boxes around it. And yet, that place is an absolute, if I had 30 lifetimes, and if technology never developed one more step in those 30 lifetimes, I would have 30 busy lifetimes of exploring the secrets of these magical wonder boxes. And just the other day I was visiting someone 2 days ago, and he had a piano in his living room, and downstairs he had an old synthesizer, not even something I had not seen before. But I found myself just drawn to that synthesizer simply because I keep, my only analogy is that it's like getting the Crayola crayon box, the 20-pound version with, you know, every imaginable color and a sharpener, and so you just can't resist using them. I do love the potential and the actuality of electronic music.
Well, it's fascinating to watch you at work up there, because you also now have in front of you a computer screen showing you visual representations of the various layers of your music, and at just the touch of a button you can change all of that. And
I've gone around actually with a grant from the Bagatus Library, obtained through the Bagatus Library, and a few on my own. I've gone around to high schools and schools just to show people how incredible some of this stuff is, because I just can't get over it myself. I mean, I can sit down and play a 6-minute piano solo on my, and feed it into the computer, record it on the computer, and go back and adjust the speed with which I hit every key throughout the whole piece individually. So if I have one note that's a little too soft, I just draw, you know, click with the mouse, and it's a little bit louder, and you know, and then I could, with just one other click of the mouse, I could play the entire piece backwards, or with another click of the mouse, I could transfer it all to drum sounds. And, you know, as I say, a lot of this doesn't really get me anywhere, but I just can't resist saying, wow, what would that sound like if I played it upside down 40 times as fast and, you know, transferred it all to a tambourine? And I have to hear what it would sound like. Usually it doesn't sound very good, but it's so great to hear it.
You can't help wondering what that no good bum Beethoven would have thought of this technology.
It was a very practical thing. I had written this a 60-minute oratorio for 22 different instruments, and it took me 8 hours to hand copy each part. And I have chronic writer's cramp. And I thought, oh my gosh, I can't see myself writing another big work like this. I cannot do it. I can't afford a copyist, and I just cannot do it myself. And I'm new on this. I mean, yesterday I got my first song all the way written down with words, just playing it on the synthesizer, and then it just puts it right up on the screen and then prints it. Oh my gosh. I'm going, oh my gosh. This is incredible.
That's the only reason that I'm allowed to be in the Maine Composers Forum, because I'm not a composer, but I arrange. And you do it on Finale, on the computer notation program. And you put it in note by note through the synthesizer, and there it is. It plays it back to you at any speed you want, and you can print it out in any part you want. And think of what poor Mozart, what might he have produced if he'd had something like this.
And what will musicians in the future be composing on?
Well, I mean, I hadn't even thought of writing for the synthesizer, but this grant that I was dance group in St. Louis is commissioning me to write a piece for them, 45-minute piece of music, and our grant for live musicians. It fell through. And I said, well, I still want to do this. I love this project. And they said, well, you know, maybe, you know, we can do it some other time. I said, well, I just got a synthesizer. And they said, oh, well, write it on that. and I'll be able to just give them the tape.
Yeah.
Well, Kay, I do want us to hear a little bit about Ouroboros, because that is a marvelous recording, an amazing project. Could you tell our listeners just briefly what that was all about?
Well, this was a woman in Denver, an elder woman, said that she wanted a piece of music kind of like Copland's Lincoln Portrait, about the cycles of women's lives, like narrator with orchestra. Well, that didn't appeal to me because I've always recorded and narrators don't go over real well on recording. So I thought, well, I'll write a piece of music, and it... me and my grandiose ideas. It ended up being a 60-minute piece of music with six soloists, 100 voice women's choir, 40-piece orchestra, and six soloists representing different ages of women, from an 8-year-old soloist to a soloist who was in her 70s but represented the 89. I used the Fibonacci series as the ages for the ages of the singers, and it was... it was premiered at the National Women's Music Festival, the 20th National Women's Music Festival, in June of 94, and is, I hear, to be done with the Denver Women's Chorus this year and other choruses. So it's been, I find that I'm writing more and more choral music for some reason. That just seems to be where my career seems to be taking me.
That's great. This is a monthly program, and each month we focus on a different art form. And in the past, we've always talked a little bit about the education of the children in our community. And I have really no idea about the health of the music programs in the local schools, or the schools in our listening area is quite large. But why is it important for children to have music be a part of their school day? Anybody have thoughts on that?
Have you seen some of the studies recently that show that children who study music and work on music from early childhood have better learning skills and everything else than children who are deprived, shall we say, of music? Yes.
And it's a great discipline, because you teach discipline to kids from the minute they start taking lessons, and so they're more focused on anything that they do. Uh-huh.
Absolutely. And everybody can be a part of that, which is why we were talking about the cost of instruments, say, for band or orchestra and so on, and how inexpensive a chorus is because mm-hmm. they bring their own instruments. Everybody can sing, but also one of the reasons that in our immediate area here, the steel band have taken off so enormously is because almost anybody can play two or three fairly simple tunes on the steel drum in one rehearsal or two. And in one semester of work at GSA, George Stevens Academy, where Carl Chase has a steel drum program, the kids who would never have the discipline or take the time to be a part of the band or orchestra will do this for a semester and get their so-called fine arts credit, but they latch on to something really important there. Whereas Steve Orlovsky does a most wonderful job with the band and all the instrumental music, and to the point where they've had to enlarge the band room 3 times in the last 5 years, I believe. Because more and more of the kids are really turned on to doing all of that.
Over in Deer Isle, Ellen Lamerson has been a godsend to us, because we went through music teachers year after year, and finally we got someone who's stuck it out and is building a program over mm-hmm. there. And it's very exciting to see that they played at the State House just recently. They did the Star Spangled Banner.
And play in tune.
Yeah. And it's just, it's great. Yeah, I think it's beginning to happen. I think mainly people think about music as a frill. I mean, I hear that so much. And if they realize that it organizes the brain, I think they might rethink it, whether or not it's a frill.
You do realize, when you think about it, how common sense will tell you that visual art, drawing, painting, helps the mind with visualizing things in science or other subjects. Just like with music, you could see how it would help someone's understanding of math. And
yes.
I mean, if you have to explain it that way, fine. But in itself, it's just a very important thing. And I do notice that high school jazz bands in Maine do seem to be very popular with the kids. This was a number of years ago, but we once had the George Stevens entire band, 22 kids playing in that room,
in the library.
Yeah. And I think that as we talk a lot about youth and violence, or youth and kids get into trouble because they don't have much to do, you can really see the positive impact of good music programs in our schools on some of these problems that we have.
It's great also because it's teamwork but not competition. You know, you're on a team, but your sole purpose is to generate joy. And that's another great aspect about being involved with music from an early age. I was thinking that you should really, you, Kathy, and WERU, this is the music and education and music in the lives of, is such a big topic and an important one. And I think there are, with all due respect to my lovely and very experienced colleagues here, I think there are people who, like Steve Orlovsky, who are doing this every day. And that it would be really worthwhile to get a group of music teachers in here, because they know more than we do. And I was never so surprised as when I was doing one of those synthesizer programs I mentioned earlier. I went to a town down east. I can't remember exactly which one it was, but it doesn't matter, because I heard it several places that I said at one point to one of the music teachers, I said, gee, it's really great to meet you as well, not only the kids, but to meet, you know, fellow musicians in the state who I wouldn't have a chance to get to know otherwise. And they were so grateful to meet me, not because I was me, but simply that they feel so isolated because there just isn't much support. And they really sometimes feel like they're lighthouses on some abandoned island 100 miles from shore. And
unfunded.
Yeah, unfunded, unrespected often, unsupported. And it's, I don't know where to go with that. It's just that I would love to know more about their lives. And then in contrast to someone like Steve Orlovsky, who is at the epicenter of a very vibrant and very excited and well-supported music world, although I'm sure he he's got his problems too. And it would be interesting to have a whole talk with music educators.
Paul, I think that will certainly be an Art Matters program in the future. And the reason I thought of this monthly series was because I, in becoming general manager of WERU, gave a lot of my production duties off to volunteers, as it should be, but I thought, I want to start a monthly program that's close to my own heart, that will just be an ongoing, endless thing. And I really perceive it as sort of radio brainstorming on the importance of the arts, and an idea like this is a perfect thing for a future program. And so it's just as it should be. You're giving more ideas, and the radio station will follow through, and we'll keep reminding ourselves and our communities why the arts are so important. And we're really down to the last 5 minutes, so I'd just like to put out this general question to all three of you for a response from each, or one, or two, or whatever. Why does music matter?
Oh, that's a story of our whole lives, isn't it? How can we? Why does it matter?
It's food for the soul. It's water. It's breath. It's the basics. I mean, I just can't imagine what life would be like with no music. It's impossible. I don't think there would be life. Because when they say in the beginning was the word, I mean, to me, in the beginning was sound and matter took shape. And I don't think that anything could be here if it weren't for vibration or for sound. And organized vibration, organized sound is music.
Mm-hmm. That's the bottom line. And music will always be here, no matter how much underfunding there is any place. They can take all the federal monies away from every program in the state of Maine, and there will still be music in Maine. There's no question about it. People will make music because it's part of their souls, and their souls need it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone knows why music matters, but I think everyone knows that it does. I've in my whole life, I often ponder what music is and why, and I'm sure we all do. And I really don't have answers, but it's like the ocean. It is there, and it is part of us, and we don't really need to know why. We need to just keep on singing and playing and feeling it. And, you know, someday maybe we'll understand it all. But I know we won't now, but so what?
Do we need to?
Right.
Do we need to?
Strike up the band. That's
all. I'm Kathy Melio, and well, go ahead, Paul.
I just had one great line that probably sums up why music, and it's just a paraphrase of a quote I heard one time. But someone once said, "In this world, with all our sorrows and all our troubles, if someone knows how to play the flute, for God's sake, let them play."
Yay.
Thanks to Kay Gardner, Mary Cheney Gould, and Paul Sullivan for coming in today and telling us why music matters. You're listening to Community Radio, the station where art does matter, WERU FM in Blue Hill. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for a variety of music with Brian Dechter on the wing.
We've been listening to Art Matters, a program from the WERU archives, first broadcast a dozen years ago. That's it for today's edition of Here Again, a special edition of Voices being broadcast on the second Saturday of the month at 3 p.m. during WERU's 20th anniversary year. If you'd like to hear this broadcast again, you can listen to it online or download it and take it with you at www.weru.org. Once there, click on Audio Archives and then on 20th Anniversary Programming. Thanks for listening, and please join us again next month for Here Again on Voices.